Welcome to the Sports Pro Podcast with Sports Pro Editorial Director James Emmett, getting right inside the sports industry and then recording it on audio.
Yes, welcome to another Sports Pro Podcast, the first of 2016. With me, Owen Connolly, the editor of Sports Pro Magazine.
Hi, James. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. Michael Long, the digital editor of Sports Pro.
Hi, James.
And staff writer and sub-editor, Adam Nelson.
Hello, James.
Coming up on the podcast, we look ahead at the key figures shaping 2016. We talk women's tennis, tech innovations that are to come in the future, but are also here now. And we have interviews with Steve Simon, the new chief executive of the Women's Tennis Association, and some of the biggest bloggers in the sports industry, including Arsblog, Swiss Ramble, and Joe Bloggs F1. Here's a question for you all. We've been away for 2 weeks, 1.5 weeks, 1 week, some days, 10 days, who knows, but we've all been away for Christmas and New Year. What sport did you watch or were struck by over that break? And I'm going to come to Owen Connolly with that first.
I watched football because this is England and that's where most people's attention is over the festive period. And I watch cricket because that's where lots of people in sunnier countries spend their time during the festive period. And England are currently in South Africa, so I watched a little bit of that. Mm-hmm. And I know a lot of people watch the darts, but I did not get a chance to do so.
I didn't watch the darts either, but I know that there was some sort of sports industry junket going off to the darts this year. I believe our colleagues at SportCal were there en masse, and by all accounts had a lovely time. Also, Repucom, they were there en masse as well. Some sort of team bonding exercise, or perhaps Santa had the same idea for all of them. Clearly not. Sports Pro not invited, but that's one for next year, perhaps. Mike, what did you get up to over the break?
One for David Cushnan, who's appeared on our podcast several times and refused to return the favour to the darts, which is a shame.
What sport did you watch, Mike?
I watched my beloved Southampton beat Arsenal 4-0 on Boxing Day. Mm-hmm. And in terms of the sports, I was struck by also football. Went down with an injury shortly before Christmas, tore the meniscus in my left knee. Mm-hmm. So that's it for my festive sport.
Mm-hmm. That's it for 2016 for you, I guess. Adam, did you watch anything exotic?
I didn't, no. I never really do. No. I watched an awful lot of soccer. Mm-hmm. I tuned into the test match on Boxing Day. Mm-hmm. A little bit of the darts. Mm-hmm. That's all. Was there anything else? You going to spring something on us? Like the big curling game that went down that we none of us tuned into.
The big curling game. No, I'm just disappointed that none of you watched the King George on Boxing Day from Kempton Park, one of the finest renewals of the race, won by Q Card, of course, and ahead of big news for British racing in that they have signed, sealed and delivered on a new rumoured £30 million 4-year broadcast deal with ITV. Listeners, all two of you will remember that we had Scott Bowers on our last podcast, who was quite coy about this whole situation, but turns out he had something up his sleeve, him and the racing industry. The rights leaving Channel 4, going to ITV, returning to ITV for the first time in 31 years. There are obviously good things and bad things coming from this deal, as there are with any broadcast deal, really. But as far as I'm concerned, the best thing to come from this is the speculation over who will be fronting this coverage. And my money is firmly with controversial daytime chat show host. Well, it's not really chat show. Interrogatory show host Jeremy Kyle. Who you can back at 5-2 to be one of the presenting team for ITV when they take over the racing coverage in 2017.
I thought you were going to say controversial Sports Pro podcast hosts. James Emmett is throwing his hat into the ring.
I'm interested in, judging by Jeremy Kyle's usual output and, with the paternity tests and so on, what this could do for the breeding side of the horse racing industry.
Are you suggesting that perhaps we should have a regular feature on the Morning Line, DNA tests for
We'll be talking millions of pounds worth of fraud here, James.
Well, it's an interesting topic and one that we should probably raise with Scott the next time he's on the podcast. Owen, you have designed, made and produced for us one of the most beautiful looking issues I've ever seen. Tell us about it.
Thanks, James. I don't know how much of the designing or production or even making I did, but we have completely revamped the look of Sports Pro. We have a new brand for 2016, which will be rolling out across the whole Sports Pro suite of events, products, services, what have you. And we have a new look, probably the most substantial redesign we've done in at least a few years, trying to bring in some new features, some new layouts to try and cram a bit more information on the page, freshen things up, just generally keep pace with a very fast-moving industry that we work in.
It does look smart. Of course, it is the first edition of the year, and there are a few staples in there that we do every year. Not least, our look ahead at the year to come, 2016, and we have picked out 10 people who we think are going to be influencing the sports industry across the next 12 months. A broad range of people, we hope, and a broad range of topics covered. We've all had a little pick and have written up those picks. I'm going to go to Owen first, since you edited the magazine and you seem to have put your piece first in it. Yanis Exarchos, you've picked. Tell me about that.
Yeah, Yanis Exarchos is the chief executive of Olympic Broadcasting Services, or OBS. They are the host broadcaster for the Olympic Games. There's an Olympics in Rio in August, which will be a pretty significant showcase, I think, for the work that OBS do. Rio being probably the most naturally striking Olympic host in recent memory, if not ever. And the Olympic broadcast being global on a scale like nothing else. It's an interesting opportunity for the Olympics to show off a major city in a way that perhaps only that event can. And you know, the games have been a bit of a hard sell in recent years. Certainly the last couple of bidding races have been pretty shallow. People are struggling to justify why they should be running Olympic Games. Perhaps a showpiece like the Rio broadcast could encourage some back into the fold for future editions when they see how powerful an asset that can be.
Well, it should be a picturesque one. I mean, we've all seen beautiful shots of Rio already with the World Cup. Of course, Yanis has got another rather large project on his plate at the moment.
He does. Well, before the Olympics begin and before the athletes start taking those planes up to Rio, he will be leading the setup and execution of the Olympic Channel launch. We're not quite sure what the Olympic Channel is yet. Or what form it's going to take beyond the fact that it is a proposed 24-hour OTT service that will be providing all Olympics all the time to anyone who might want it.
Word is they're taking a lot of inspiration from Vice Media Group, which I find quite perplexing. But there we go. We're all waiting with bated breath to see what that looks like when it launches pre-Rio, they're aiming for. Another pick that we've got for a potential influencer across 2016 is Sydney Levy. He's the chief executive of Rio 2016, for obvious reasons. He must deliver the games. And they're always touted as the single largest out-of-wartime logistical event. They will be once again. He's obviously going to have to do that against a backdrop of increasing criticism about, obviously, they had infrastructural delays a while ago. They seem to have petered out. Now it's all about pollution in waters that will be used for the games. Plus, Rio 2016 organizing committee is suffering from serious budgetary concerns as the Brazilian economy continues to struggle. Elsewhere, Mr. Mike Long, you have written about another great Olympian and someone who did not struggle that much to deliver the last summer games, Lord Sebastian Coe.
Yeah, well, it seems like Lord Coe has gone a bit from hero to zero in that sense. Yeah, he's got obviously a tough year ahead. I'd say that probably no no sports administrator has got a tougher year ahead in terms of the challenges he faces with the Russian doping scandal. Obviously, he terminated his commercial ties with Nike, and he's, you know, taken some action on the Russian doping front. But there's of course much more to come from him, and much more to come from the WADA Ethics Commission as well. The second part of their report. I know the author, Dick Pound, of course, said it was going to be more explosive this time round. So he's got all of that to face. And Olympic Games to preside over, you know, what happens with the Russian athletes. So, yeah, I mean, in terms of Ko's reputation, you know, hasn't unravelled yet. But, you know, he's got to do his best to keep athletics, the world of athletics, together as best he can.
These are all great and well described and explained. But who's going to throw me a wild card?
Lisa Franz Kennedy.
Adam.
Maybe something of a wild card. She is NASCAR royalty. And she is this year going to be mainly charged with finding a replacement for Sprint as the title sponsor of the Sprint Cup Series in NASCAR, mm-hmm. the biggest series. And it's kind of one of those sponsorships that it just makes sense. It's got a lot of synergy around it. It sounds like it took me a while to realize that it was a sponsorship. I thought it was just called that because it's fast. Turns out that's not the case. It is a title sponsorship, and they've put a price of $1 billion over 10 years, reportedly, on replacing that title sponsor. Mm-hmm. So they are serious about finding a big name, kind of blue chip company who can come in and provide instant continuity on that front.
Mm-hmm. Lisa Franz Kennedy, of course, is also the chief executive of the International Speedway Corporation, and she'll be overseeing the. The launch and the unveiling of the Daytona Rising project this year, which is a huge upgrade of facilities at one of NASCAR's blue chip tracks, I suppose. Just picking up on your point about Sprint, I too didn't know or couldn't recognize that Sprint was a sponsorship name. I just thought, yeah, that makes sense as a name of a series. And I also thought similarly for the two series below the Sprint Cup. So obviously the Sprint Cup first, then it was the Nationwide Series, and I simply thought, well, that one's probably across the country. I can understand what's happening there. And then below that, the third tier is obviously called the Camping World Truck Series. And without ever having watched the third tier of NASCAR, I assume that it was done in camping trucks. It's not the case, though, and fortunately, I learnt. Anyway, moving on. One influencer that we have, not necessarily a wild card, but someone whose influence, I suppose, was quite suddenly increased towards the end of 2015, was the new chief executive of the Women's Tennis Association, Steve Simon. He, of course, was brought in and started his job at the beginning of December, or late November, early December, replacing Stacey Allister, chief executive and chairman of the WTA, who left quite suddenly in September or October. September or October time, with at least a year of her contract left to run. People thought that the organisation would float on rudderless for a bit as a new chief was sought. But Steve Simon, former tournament director at Indian Wells, was picked up, brought in and installed within the space of about a month. We tracked him down, we interviewed him, his first interview with any major sports industry outlet. And we can hear about that in part three.
Listeners, not finding this podcast too boring? Then why not check out the Sports Pro website, where fresh sports industry news, views, features and interviews are uploaded every single day. Visit sportspromedia.com, download the Sports Pro app, subscribe to the Sports Pro podcast on iTunes, maybe even treat yourself to a monthly Sports Pro magazine subscription. Delve deeper into the sports industry with Sports Pro.
Welcome back to part three. Michael Long, you and I have got a byline on this piece. It's about a man called Steve Simon, and predictably the headline is...
Simon Says.
Correct, Owen, it's Simon Says. Mike, obviously we put this together on the back of an interview, snippets of which we will hear soon. Why did Stacey Allister leave the WTA?
Well, she cited personal reasons for leaving the WTA. I mean, you can't really think of any other reason why she would want to leave such a position, to be honest.
Mm-hmm. And who is Steve Simon? Why was he appointed?
So he was Chief Operating Officer and Tournament Director of Indian Wells, obviously considered, revered tennis event outside of the four Grand Slams, often considered the fifth slam. He and his South African colleague, Raymond Moore, turned that into an incredible tournament for media, sponsors, fans. You know, everybody raves about it each March. Always beautiful weather there, although I don't think Steve Simon had anything to do with that. And he's obviously a tennis guy through and through. Mm-hmm. I think he was a very low-ranked player, but he was a player nonetheless and a coach.
I believe he played in a doubles tournament at Wimbledon, the finest of the four Grand Slams, at some stage in the late 70s, early 80s.
Yeah, before my time.
Mm. You're absolutely right, Mike. He also had a spell working for Adidas. He wasn't quite flogging Stan Smith's, although those were being sold to fund the programs he was setting up across the west coast of America in the early 80s before he joined Indian Wells. He's been at Indian Wells for many, many years. He obviously takes the hot seat at a time when women's tennis is probably, I think, objectively lagging a little bit behind men's tennis, reputationally, certainly, in terms of star power. Men's tennis has of course, benefited from the Big Four being so spectacular and renowned for so long. Obviously, women's tennis has Serena Williams, who is an absolute tour de force, and Maria Sharapova, although both of those probably leaving the game sooner rather than later. Mike, I'm going to stick with you. Obviously, you've got serious tennis chops on you. What are the challenges facing Steve Simon as he goes into this role?
I think obviously it's no secret the one of Alistair's prerogatives was to move to Asia, focus on the Asia Pacific region, which is obviously swelled the calendar somewhat. I'm not sure whether they got 10 tournaments now in China. Obviously that requires a lot of travel for the players, so the calendar is one big challenge for them, you know, ensuring the likes of Serena Williams, who remains injured. She pulled out of every tournament after last year's US Open. So keeping the big names fit is one challenge for him. Another challenge is it's been ongoing really for a number of years, which is finding a title sponsor for the tour. Mm-hmm. Obviously, Simon and his team will be working on that. As you say, it's then just keeping up with the men's game. You know, there was talk from Simon's predecessors of bringing the women's game more closely in line with the men's game as one means of doing it. And I know in your interview with Simon, he extols the virtues of bringing men's and women's tennis together, obviously being a tournament director of Indian Wells, which is a combined event. How he approaches that will be interesting.
Mm. Let's maybe go to that interview now and lead off with that point. Steve Simon talking about the close relationship that he has with Chris Kermode from the ATP. And the chairman and chief executives of all the Grand Slams around the world.
I've spoken with Chris and David and a couple of the Slams. I should say all the Slams. We've spoken with all of them. Mm-hmm. I have a good relationship with all of them. I've been around the game for a long time, so I think that helps. And I believe that we're going to collaborate amongst us in a very positive way. And while we all have our respective businesses to run, and we probably won't agree on everything all the time, There's no reason or excuse that we can't have open and respective dialogues at all times, and I believe that we will amongst this group. We know each other pretty well. You know, the foundation for any successful business, from my perspective, is its infrastructure. Mm. And based upon this, I'm going to be embarking on a full review of the organizational structure, the systems and procedures, and the hard infrastructure that we have to make sure that we're able to and are operating as efficiently and effectively as we can as an organization. I'm also going to begin working on addressing the challenges we face within the calendar. You know, our calendar currently is supporting 54 regular tour events, 2 year-end events, 4 Grand Slams, and 2 weeks set aside for Fed Cup over a 44-week period. That's certainly a lot of tennis and difficult for the players to get through, as it's a very, very long year. You know, as the players are a product, and it's critical that we, I think it's critical that we look at what changes we could make that will allow the athletes the best opportunity to remain healthy, and we can have as much success as possible in keeping them on the court. You know, the change, of course, will take some time and we'll need to evolve, but we will be embarking on a full review of the calendar with the goal of determining what do we need to do to address the challenges that can be resolved quickly, as well as those that I think that are going to take more time.
Oh my gosh, it's back again. Sports Pro Live, Sports Pro's flagship industry conference, returns with a bang in 2016. Over 2 days at Wembley Stadium in London, we'll showcase the brand new models, concepts and technologies that are reshaping the sports and media landscapes. We're expecting hundreds of international delegates to join us on the 22nd and 23rd of March, and we'd love you to be there.
Join us!
Yes, welcome back, and do join us on the 22nd and 23rd of March. It's going to be a good one. Already signed up to speak, we've got Greg Carey from Goldman Sachs, Chris Lencheski from IRG Sports and Entertainment, former Olympic Minister Sir Hugh Robertson, Reggie Bradford from Oracle, and Yanis Exarchos, who we talked about earlier, who's going to be masterminding the Olympic Channel and running the Olympic Broadcasting Service as per usual over Rio 2016. Also, we have Marius Wiese, Chief Executive of the IJF, International Judo Federation, and controversial, inflammatory former leader of Sport Accord. George Pine, former IMG and NASCAR executive, who's now running his own investment firm, Bruin Sports Capital, and Peter Hutton, the lovely Chief Executive of Eurosport. On with events of now and of the future. Owen and Adam, you have produced, a puzzling piece on technological innovations that are both of the future and of the present, it seems to me. The future here now is what it's called, but you're showcasing some pretty nifty bits of kit.
Quite so. It's things that, well, they're not quite here now. They haven't quite broken into the mainstream in every case. But it's looking at things that are going to transform the experience of the sports industry for the fan and the way that sports teams, sports organisations reach the fan. There's three sections. We have the viewing experience, the in-stadium experience, and the fan relationship of the future. The first one, the viewing experience, is pretty much centred on virtual reality. So I suppose that's a good place for us to start. Virtual reality is about to have its moment in the sun. It's been off the radar, if I can mix my own metaphors there, for about 15, 20 years. In the early 90s, it was very much the thing that was about to happen, and it just was in no way ready for the mainstream. It was expensive, it was clunky, it was not very well executed. But what you have now is these very high-end, sophisticated headsets coming in at the kind of luxury end of the consumer market. But what's going to be more interesting for the sports industry is at the other end, this cinematic VR experience that you can have on a smartphone with a headset holding it in place in front of your gaze.
Is that the likes of Google Cardboard?
Well, Google Cardboard is the very, it's, you know, catering to the very, very bottom end of that experience. So yeah, Google Cardboard, I think, is a series of apps and videos and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Well, not a series of apps, but a series of VR experiences. But the cardboard refers to the fact that you can literally fashion one of these headsets out of a bit of cardboard, put your smartphone in the right place, playing stereoscopic VR video, and you'll get the experience in some shape, anyway.
I think broadcasters, federations, rights holders, probably a little, everyone's excited about VR technology, but I think organizations in the sports industry are probably treading a little bit carefully at the moment, having been stung, no doubt, by 3D, the rise and dramatic fall of 3D. Nobody talks about 3D anymore, and any technological innovation in the broadcast space seems to be immediately compared to 3D. Are we genuinely, from the research that you did for this piece, Owen, can you see virtual reality killing the traditional TV experience, supplementing in a long-term way the TV experience, or can you see it burning brightly before crashing away like a rubbish star?
Companies that are pushing this kind of experience, particularly Jaunt, who are kind of the putative market leader in cinematic VR. They have their own bespoke cameras and have partnerships with lots of people in very high places. Are naturally enough trying to distinguish themselves from 3D television. I think there's two important distinctions to make. One is that 3D TV was kind of foisted on people a little bit. A lot of it came from Hollywood. A lot of it came from some concerns about piracy and a need to get people into the cinemas. And that kind of then led on to 3D technology make its way into the home when perhaps it wasn't really an experience that people wanted.
But the reason that they didn't like it was because they had to wear headsets.
Well, there's two things again, sub-point A and sub-point B. The headsets, you're putting them on in order to have that experience, and it can be quite a brief thing. You're having kind of bespoke video created for you. It's not for a live experience at the moment. It is for watching kind of a 10-minute video, which might be extreme sports based. It might be something they've done with ABC News at Jaunt is to take a camera into North Korea so you can have a look around at a military parade at some kind of typical North Korean sites, which is not something any of us are going to do anytime soon. And, you know, they have a video where you can watch the national anthem from home plate at City Field as the New York Mets prepare to play. So it's that kind of thing that they're pushing at the moment. It's a lot of free content. And it's kind of, it's, you know, for idling away time and escaping rather than consuming the thing that you would be anyway. In the longer term, I think the idea is that they'll move away from headsets more towards projections, augmented reality, that kind of thing. But, you know, people can get ahead of themselves a little bit. But the point is that this is stuff that's here now and it's free and it's very accessible to the many hundreds of millions of people around the world who have smartphones.
Jaunt, Oculus, all you virtual reality companies out there, listen up. Here's a pitch. Why don't you step up for a one-off sponsorship of the Sports Pro podcast, and I will trial your product right here in the upstairs room of the White Swan pub near the Sports Pro HQ for a live virtual reality podcast experience, looking at Owen Connolly, Mike Long, and Adam Nelson simultaneously. Think about that.
That would be extraordinary.
Adam, Mike, have either of you used virtual reality?
Yes. It was fun. I had an experience that I was surfing, but I actually wasn't surfing. So that was good, because I've never been surfing. Yeah. So in terms of, I think what differentiates it from 3D TV is that, as Owen said, you're doing this for a very specific experience. It's not you're sitting down with your friends to watch something on a big screen and then you all have to wear glasses and look silly. You're doing it to have that immersive you can feel it experience. So you, there's a kind of different mindset that you're getting into approaching this that's different from just watching TV. And I think even if they do manage to get the technology into the place where it's, you can watch it live, I still think there's enough of a difference about the experience that people will want to do that. Once it gets towards projections and augmented reality, I think then it might again start to struggle, because I think if you're able to do that, you're able to sit down and watch it on a big TV with your friends like you would do in a pub or at your house, and you're not going to bother with all the kind of extra fancy things that go around that.
It obviously gets you closer to the action, but I think, certainly from my experience pretending that I was Bodie Miller going down a ski slope, I think it probably disassociates you from any other people that you might be watching sport with. So you enhance the communion with the athlete, but you destroy the communion with the fellow spectator. That's my take on it at the moment. Mike, have you used this technology?
I haven't used it, but on that point, I think it's very much, you know, VR is very much complementary to the, you know, traditional TV situation that you view a game with your family and friends as a communal experience. If it's going to kill anything, it's going to kill the mobile, you know, how you watch things on mobile or through social media that's delivered to your mobile. That's already, anyone that's sat on a train in London will know that that's already a pretty private experience. You know, you're pretty much shutting out the rest of the world when you've got your headphones in and you're scanning through your phone. So VR, you know, they've got to go down that route with it, you know.
It might kill second screen as well, the whole concept of second screen. I think lots of sports consumers now probably don't like the idea of a super immersive broadcast experience, because, you know, you're watching something on a big screen, maybe a TV. You've also got your phone, which you're flicking through Twitter on. Maybe you've got an iPad or some sort of tablet where you are watching something else that's going on, or scores from elsewhere. Being stuck in one thing and not being able to do anything else might be a little bit alarming for the modern day sports viewer, or at least they'll feel, you know, they'll get FOMO, won't they? Let's move away from VR, but keep with this idea of innovation that is here with us today. Adam, you've got a byline on this piece.
Yeah.
How did you contribute?
I spoke to a man called David Burney, who has developed a mobile application, also a desktop browser plugin called Premier Browser, which is for at the moment soccer clubs. It's Everton and Manchester City have it at the moment, but he's in talks with other European clubs and wants to get 20 by the end of this year. And basically what it does is it gives you what on the surface is just a kind of novelty club branded browser for your phone or for your computer, but beneath the surface it's collecting your data and giving that back to the clubs. So the clubs know what you're looking for and how you're searching for it, which they obviously wouldn't generally. It also offers cash back on any purchases that you make with companies that are collaborating with the browser. So you buy something through Amazon, the Everton Charitable Foundation will get a cut of that. And what it also does is promotes local businesses to the clubs. So David Burney gave an example of a Liverpool builder who gave up his free time to build a roof for a school. Don't know why the school didn't have a roof, but he put one on there anyway. And he did that off his own back, exactly. Did that off his own back. And because of that, he now returns the first result if you're in Liverpool and you search for a builder. So it gives things back to people who've done something for their community. Mm-hmm. And the idea is it brings fans closer together, because you're within the kind of closed wall of the Everton browser, and it brings you Everton-based results, and you give something back by buying stuff, and the club gets to use what you've done in that browser themselves.
And you think fans are, you know, obviously fans have special relationships with this product that they're consuming week in, week out, and clearly there isn't necessarily a problem with people minding that their data, their personal data, is being quite blatantly mined and marketed.
So I think the thing that you have to accept is that that's going to happen anyway, and if it's going to, the freedom that it gives you is choosing where that data goes and who's using it. And rather than, obviously the ideal is that none of your data is mined and used by anybody, but if it's going to be saying, well, I'd rather that my football club had this, and then they know who is browsing where and they can use that to monetize, in various parts of the world or whatever they use it for.
Mm-hmm. Of course, another element of the sports experience that's rich with possibility for technological innovation is the in-venue experience. Owen, you spoke to a cheerful-looking chap with a beard from San Francisco. He was telling you all about the 49ers' new stadium.
Yeah, John Paul is the founder and chief executive of a company called Venue Next, which is actually a spin-off of the organization that runs the Santa Clara Stadium, the Levi's Stadium, which is home of the San Francisco 49ers and will be hosting the Super Bowl in a few weeks' time. Venue Next were basically set up to run the Levi's Stadium experience because Levi's Stadium was established as this, you know, Silicon Valley inspired, ultra futuristic, open venue match day experience host thing. And they found that there wasn't really anybody else offering the kind of platforms that they needed, so they did it themselves. And they've subsequently begun taking that to other venues in the US and I am sure beyond in the time to come. Basically, what it's doing, it's interesting. I started at Sportsbro a few years ago and pretty much the entire time people have been talking about things like contactless payments in stadiums, ordering food and beverage from your seats, you know, buying your tickets on the way to the ground, that kind of stuff. What's happening now is that the smartphone platforms that are available to people that they use all the time are making it possible to bring all of those things together. And that's essentially what Venue Next does. They, at least at the user end, you have one app. It does your wayfinding, it does your ticketing, it does your purchasing. You know, you can swipe your phone under the barrier as you go in the way that you might do at an airport if you've got a boarding pass on your phone. All that stuff's coming together. And then at the provider end, at the team's end, it's collecting your data. It's helping with mass movement of people through the venue, and it's, you know, live accounting, all kinds of information.
Well, it'll be fascinating to see it in action for the Super Bowl coming up on the 7th of February. I hope that the system is all systems go for that. I won't be there, neither will any of you, so we shouldn't care that much. That'll do for that part. Coming up in the final part of the podcast, blogs. Welcome back to the final part of the first Sports Pro podcast of 2016. And we're going to begin this part, or I'm going to begin this part, with a question to my colleagues here in the pub. Adam, you read blogs.
I do. I don't write any, but I do read some. I'm going to talk about a soccer one, which is kind of boring, but I think it's interesting. So I support Leeds United, who are no longer haven't been for a long time a Premiership club. So the reason that blogs are important to me is that they don't get mainstream media coverage anymore. And there are two or three really great Leeds United blogs, because obviously they've got a huge fan base, a lot of fans who are very passionate about the club, and no big coverage. So you go further down the ladder in any sport and you find more and more points of interest now because of blogs, more and more people who are producing really good content, which just doesn't get the mainstream coverage. Mm-hmm. And that's one thing that I think is really positive about them.
I think there are obviously lots of things about this topic, but I think the rise in popularity of blogs is partly to do with the fact that it's become easier and easier to do them. It's also partly to do with the fact that the mainstream traditional media has decreased in... not necessarily decreased in size, but priorities have been dissipated, I suppose. Especially in the digital online space, traditional journalists have to fight with all sorts of people whose job is not traditional journalism for clicks. And that creates a rather difficult environment. But anyway, I've written this piece in the latest edition of the magazine on the rise of blogs and bloggers, obviously in the sports industry, and I spoke to three prominent bloggers for this. Swiss Ramble, who sports business observers and journalists will know as pretty much the authority now on soccer finance, football finance, not just in England but across Europe. He is a fascinating man. Kieran O'Connor is his name. He doesn't prize his anonymity anymore. He works in finance in Switzerland. It is just a hobby for him, but he is a first-class analyst of finance in general, but specifically football finance. He's a polyglot. He speaks about four or five languages, and he enjoys the challenge of looking through the books of foreign teams more than English teams. Nevertheless, his audience is mainly English language. I also spoke to Arseblog, probably almost certainly one of the longest standing, if not the longest standing, Arsenal fan sites, I suppose. Andrew Mangan is Arseblog's name. He's an Irishman based in Dublin who started the blog in the early 2000s. When he was based in Barcelona, selling basically off the peg websites to small businesses around that city and around the world. And he's carried on, and he's a daily producer, multiple posts, different platforms. His blog has essentially flourished into a media business. He has several different platforms. He's even moving into events now. Very, very popular, and has a pretty solid rationale for why he does it and what he wants to come of it. And the other blogger that I spoke to was Joe Bloggs F1, aka Joe Saywood, who is a traditional media journalist but has turned to pretty much daily blogging in order, for a different reason from the other two, but as a business tool for himself to essentially post his credentials to the world, to potential employers and potential readers, on a daily basis, to essentially prove that he is in and amongst the Formula One circus day in, day out. And all three of them had some interesting things to say about why they do it and about the fields that they write about on a daily basis. And here are some snippets now. Kieran O'Connor, aka the Swiss Ramble.
I'd always thought this would be an incredibly niche market, but there was a lot more interest than I'd expected, and it's only sort of really got bigger. And it's quite funny because you see quite a few mainstream journalists now, including some that in the past have sort of scoffed about the concept of looking at the business of sport and said, let's get the ball out. And I can sort of see where they're coming from. Mm. But there is a lot of interest. And, the reality is that money talks in sport. And what I try to do is, although it is fairly dry stuff, I do try to provide a narrative. And what interests me is trying to find a thread that explains why a club is acting as it does, mm-hmm. Whether they be successful or unsuccessful for that matter. Mm. A good example of that would be, I remember writing a blog about Milan, and one of my things, it's a little bit cheesy, but I like to put in music references and mm-hmm. sort of given my age, they tend to be sort of 80s, maybe even late 70s.
Yeah.
And I called the Milan blog Warning Signs, mm-hmm. after an old Talking Heads number. And I was saying, they're in trouble because they're going to be absolutely banjaxed by financial fair play. Mm-hmm. And they've got the added dimension that Berlusconi doesn't really want to put money in anymore. So I said, I can see them falling off, and I can see them having to sell some big names like Ibrahimovic and Thiago Silva, and then about a month later, that's exactly what they did.
Yeah.
So that was a bit of a lucky punch. But, I try to make the subject interesting, mm-hmm. as it can be. And I try to make it comprehensible to the sort of average man in the street. And that's where I have an advantage over journalists, because I don't have any constraints on space and how much I can cover. And to get a really good explanation of what's happening at a club, you need to sort of take it in detail. And I mean, your average newspaper is never going to give more than a few hundred words to this subject. It's really tough for a journalist to properly explain what is happening at a club. And I have the luxury that I can write about what I want, when I want, and to whatever depth I want.
Can you tell me how many people roughly read the blog every time? I know sort of the Liverpool, Man U, Arsenal get more hits, but in general, how many readers are you getting?
It really depends. So if you took, I would say that my best has been about 50,000.
Yeah.
For a particular piece.
Yeah, and what? And what?
Maybe more, because I don't sort of track back.
And what piece was that?
That was a piece on Manchester City, which was quite interesting, because when Financial Fair Play first came out, nobody really understood it.
Yeah.
And I delved quite deeply into it. And I think I was probably the first person to write an article that explained, this is obviously going to cause City issues, but this is how I think they will address those issues. And I sort of basically wrote like a 10-point plan. And pretty well every one of those has come true. And that was one of the reasons. It's one of the reasons I do the blog. So I think, well, I can probably see things like this without necessarily following the party line. Because at that point, which was about 4 years ago, there was a very clear narrative that City were completely screwed, and FFP would absolutely stop any development plans they had. I mean, it's all changed now. I mean, you see plenty of people. I mean, there's an article in the Mirror this week where they were saying, "Isn't it wonderful what City have done for their community, etc., etc." And I thought, yeah, things change. But I would say that on average, it's probably about 15,000 to 20,000.
Yeah. Okay.
You never know. I mean, so I wrote about Southampton a few weeks ago, and that one did really well.
Yeah.
It's not always obvious which ones do well. And if you get a link from one of the traditional media out there, so if the BBC link me or the Guardian or someone like that, then it goes through the roof.
Yeah. How many Premier League clubs at the moment do you believe are run properly from a financial point of view?
I would say that the vast majority are now. I mean, you can see a real change over the last few years in terms of how they're run. And they all have individual strategies. I'd say most of them, it's a fairly simple strategy, which is we need to survive in the Premier League because 75 to 80% of our money comes from the TV deal, which is only getting bigger. So it's really sort of looking at that. There are others that have modified their behaviour. So if you took Chelsea as an example, in Abramovich's early years, he just spent whatever was necessary to take the club to the highest level. And what they've done now is said, okay, that no longer works in an era of financial fair play, so we have to find an alternative. And they have this sort of approach to the loan market, which is not unique. I mean, Udinese, amongst others, have done something similar for many years. But, they've got over 50 players out on loan, and a very small number of those are likely to progress to their first team squad. But it provides useful money and funding. And not only does that work from an FFP perspective, but it also shows that people understand that the slightly strange world of football accounting, where, when you buy and sell players, if you sell players, you get an immediate profit. And when you buy a player, you expense him over the length of his contract. And by the way, you can see that clubs tend to buy players on longer contracts now, so it's a lower annual expense in the books. So, you know, even a club like Chelsea, which before would have been regarded as extremely cavalier and not caring, they've adopted their behaviour and have a smart strategy. The other thing that clubs have done, which is very noticeable, is say, OK, the TV deal is great, but it's distributed really equitably. So, you know, it's like in the old Warren Buffett saying, a rising tide floats all boats. And so, you know, you're good, but how good are you compared to your rivals? So, and you can't do that much on ticket pricing. So the only avenue left is commercially. And a few years ago, clubs really hadn't bothered too much about this and were left in the shade by the Bundesliga, for example. But now you can see that they're all really sort of focusing on that. The challenge is that if the companies they want to deal with, they all want to deal with the same small band of clubs. So that's really one of the things that is differentiating the elite from the sort of mid-tier clubs is the commercial business. Yeah. It's not a case of focus or even acumen. It's just, you know, people would rather be associated with Manchester United than Swansea City.
Yeah.
And Swansea City, by the way, are a very well-run club.
Joe Saywood, a.k.a. Joe Bloggs F1.
There's a lot of people out there who pretend to be in Formula One and aren't. And by showing pictures and telling stories of life in the paddock, you personalise it, you make the travel you know, feel real to the readers. But underlying that, you know, you make a very clear point that you are there and part of the game. And so that was the sparking point, if you like, and then the underlying strategy of it. But fundamentally, it's really only it's an advertising medium, really, isn't it? I'm advertising my knowledge, connections, ability to write, hopefully, and engaging with the fans, which is something that Formula One does very badly.
So it's almost as if that your blog is your credentials that you're refreshing on a daily basis.
It's my credibility, I suppose, is the answer. I mean, the thing is, it's a bit weird because I've been around Formula One for 25 years, so lots of people know me.
Yeah.
In the industry, obviously, you know, if you've been around long enough, people find out who you are. But it is a way of how do I describe it? If you're constantly hitting on the key points that are going on, the business recognizes that you are someone that they have to keep an eye on, and someone they have to try to have on their side, if you like. So I spend a lot of time trying to work out who's bullshitting me or not. But you know, it's based on personal relationships, and obviously, you know, an awful lot of the industry, most sports industries nowadays, are more and more about press releases and less about individual contact. And so this is, and that's where I score, because I've got, along with, it's not just me, there are four or five others who run very good blogs, who, you know, can get in there and ask the questions that need to be asked and tell the stories that the fans need to know. And it's a very different style too, because it's, I'm not going in there to try and, you know, write exposés and negative stuff, because, you know, a motor racing journalist is a funny, it's a funny position, because you're sort of promoting the business at the same time as critiquing it, which makes it a bit of a balancing act. And you know, if there are negative stories, I can explain. I mean, there are a lot of negative stories about, because you have the hit and run journalists who come in and do look for good stuff to give them a headline. But if you're there in the middle, you can explain, well, actually, it's not quite like that. It's a little bit like this. And you know, and I won't hold back, and I will be critical when things need to be critical, but I try to be critical in a positive way.
And in terms of this sort of ongoing process of spreading Formula One to every nook and cranny around the world, you're obviously someone who follows the circus, and I suppose, you know, you're part of the circus in a way. And what do you make of going to, you know, going to all these far flung non-traditional markets?
Well, I'm all in favour of going to new markets, except there's a couple of things. That one is you have to have a clear strategic object for going there. So China, that's a slam dunk, that's easy. Mm-hmm. India, same thing. You've got a big emerging middle class, you have lots of future customers. That all makes sense. Going to Azerbaijan makes no sense at all. Mm. Now, this is a country which has got the population the size of Paris and just a few people with loads and loads of oil money. So that really is where a race is going in there to be used by the government to make their country look good, important, whatever they want to do. European, in their case. They want to pretend to be European on a fairly nebulous argument about a very small area to the north of the Caucasus Mountains. But, you know, this is what they're trying to achieve. I don't like it when we're going to places and we are setting up agendas that aren't necessarily real. I think we should be. The world's biggest consumer market is the United States of America, mm-hmm. and we're barely in it. So that's wrong. Mm-hmm. Fundamentally, we're too expensive a sport for the American market, but we won't budge on price, and we won't budge enough on price. And that doesn't make sense to me. We should be very big in America because it's European chic, it's glitzy, it's glamorous. It's what the two coasts like very much. Mm. And, you know, we appear in Austin and we'll disappear in Austin fairly soon because they can't afford to pay for it. Mm. So, you know, it just doesn't make any sense. But, you know, going to Mexico, for example, fabulous move. It's a good economy. It's a good emerging market. Got a good tradition in Formula One. It was a fantastic event, and then you have growth that is good growth. Mm. And I hope in the future we'll go to Argentina when they sort that out a little bit. You know, you've got these big markets that are waiting and have the traditions of Formula One. Mm. I don't mind going to the other ones which don't have the traditions, but you've got to be there a very long time. And we've been in China now for, I don't know, 10 years probably, and we're just beginning to generate a big audience every year. Now, we went to Korea. It was a disaster. We went to India. It was very short term. You know, you've got to be in it for a long time. Mm. But the local promoters can't really afford to pay for it.
Mm. Mm. So there needs to be a bit of give and take there, I suppose.
Well, you need to. Yeah, I mean, I sort of agree in a way, because if you look at what the Olympics does or the World Cup, they get vast amounts of money, and they're a one-off hit. Okay, you get a lot of infrastructure that comes with that, which helps economies, etc. But in terms of the actual media hit you get, the Olympics gets 2 weeks. And Formula One, you know, every year, 16 different places, every 2 weeks you're getting another hit of Formula One. So the individual race promoters, they get a small hit, but they're not paying very much for it. Mm. And they're getting a very big audience for a relatively small hit. Mm. But having said that, you know, in Western Europe, for example, or in America, there's no government that's going to be able to pay for it nowadays, simply because in a democratic world, there are other things that are more important money-wise.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that's where you have the sort of dichotomy of... And you're squeezing pay television as well. You're pushing people towards pay television, and the numbers dropping off, so the sponsors are dropping off. It's a difficult one. I think in the end, direct-to-consumer television will probably be the answer.
Andrew Mangan, a.k.a. Arseblog.
But it seems to me that there's an explosion of all these people being able to publish what they want about the thing that they like, and a lot have fallen by the wayside. You know, people aren't as regular anymore. I don't know, they've lost interest or they've lost audience or something. But obviously you and a few others maintain what you're doing. Do you think that the regularity and the frequency of what you do is one of the most crucial elements to maintain?
It's absolutely key to everything, because people come to expect it.
Yeah,
where is this free thing I get every morning? Yeah, yeah. I want it now. Yeah. And if it's late, I'm unhappy about it. Yeah. And I get that, because when you come to expect something from, you know, from somebody that whose stuff you enjoy reading, or maybe you don't enjoy reading it, maybe you hate what I do, but you still come and read it. There's, you know, there's that element of it too. So yeah, it is. It's really important that once I've often spoken to my dad about this, and he said, like, you've created the beast. Mm. Now you have to keep feeding the beast. Yeah. And every time we add something new on, you know, we've got to maintain that too.
Yeah.
You know, where is the match report? If the match report's not up within 5 minutes, people are like, where is it?
Do you work hard to try and sell advertising?
I don't work hard to try and sell advertising. I mean, normally I was just using Google AdSense to
right,
do it.
Yeah, yeah.
But in the last few months, I've outsourced it to a company in the UK who can optimize the advertising revenue and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Which has gone, you know, I'm not 100%, because one of the things I've always been, I really don't like intrusive advertising on websites.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't want pop-ups. Mm-hmm. I don't want anything that obscures the content.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want interstitials. I don't want pop-unders. Mm-hmm. I don't want content video marketing, ads. I don't want native advertising.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I'm happy to do bits and pieces if it's relevant,
yeah,
but I'm not going to, like, you know,
competitions, I suppose. Are
competitions
good,
are good, but then, you know, you get big companies saying, oh, we want to do a competition with you, blah, blah, blah. And I said, well, that's fine, but there's a competition fee. And they're like, what?
Hmm.
I'm going, well, hang on a minute. What you're asking for is free advertising on my website, essentially. And for me to push that and give you front page of the website and everything else.
And all you might get is one of their products.
And I might get a t-shirt. Fuck off.
Yeah, yeah.
So pay me.
Yeah.
Most of the time they don't.
Yeah.
They're not interested in it because they're going through a PR company, and the PR company is saying, well, we'll get you all this coverage for nothing.
Best ever piece of content.
I know what it is, and it's ridiculous. It is a story about players changing numbers. That, I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
But if you talk about what number a player wears,
yeah,
Hector Bellerin has changed from 54 to 26 or whatever it was. And I think it was from Abu Dhabi changing from number 2 to number 20-something. Yeah. And it was, like, and that kind of stuff gets weird reach.
Yeah.
The live blogs that we do on Transfer Deadline Day, they get a lot of reach as well.
Mm-hmm.
And generally speaking, the stuff that tends to get the most kind of feedback is when something goes wrong or when there's been a bad game.
Outside of the UK, where are the biggest markets?
America.
And then beyond America?
Ireland, Australia.
English speaking,
India.
Mm-hmm.
But it's about 45% UK,
mm-hmm.
25%
US. Yeah.
Rest of world then comes in after that, yeah.
Okay. And have you noticed any particular, you know, rise from any areas?
USA is like, they've really embraced football and really embraced Arsenal. And, you know, we went
NBC,
over there.
NBC deal was huge for them.
Amazing. We went over there and did a book launch last year when Arsenal played in New York.
Hmm.
We sold more books in New York than we did in London.
Really? Right, that'll do for the first Sports Pro podcast of 2016. Just remains for me to thank my guests. Thank you very much, Owen Connolly.
Thanks, James.
Thank you very much, Michael Long.
Thank you.
And thank you very much, Adam Nelson.
Thanks, James.